Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
We are going to talk today about tortured poets, including those two tortured poets. Let me get a couple of housekeeping things out of the way. Well, the first thing I should say is the reason we're talking about tortured poets is because Taylor Swift is about to release an album called the Tortured Poets Department. We don't know too much more about it, although we do know, well, we can come to that. And then because of some of the things we're going to talk about today, about instances of mental illness and suicide among poets, we just want to kind of caution you that that content's coming. If it strikes a nerve, if it triggers anything, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available online and on the phone 24 hours a day. You can go online to 988lifeline.org, or you can just dial 988. We don't want to have anybody getting any ideas from the things that we talk about today. However, I think also we can create a pretty safe space to talk about all this. And here we go. We're going to begin. We are honored to have Roland Green, professor of English and Comparative Literature and director of the Humanities Center at Stanford University. He is editor-in-chief of the Princeton Encyclopedia of Poetry and Poetics. His newest book is Five Words, Critical Semantics in the Age of Shakespeare and Cervantes. Roland Green, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Colin. Good morning from San Francisco.
I wish I were there. So this is an idea. It's interesting because, and this is the last time I'll mention Taylor Swift, but she does appear to be interested in the so-called lake poets. She appears to have visited Wordsworth's grave. And in a way, this idea of the tortured poet probably starts around then. In the period covered by your book, I think we know less. We don't have any idea whether Christopher Marlowe was a tortured playwright and poet or not. And we certainly don't know whether, you know, Horace and Catullus were tortured poets. We know Catullus was very horny, but other than that, you know, this is kind of an idea that maybe begins in the Romantic period.
Absolutely. It's, first of all, it's definitely an idea that has a history. And, you know, before the Romantic period, I would say in the West, in Western culture, for most of the time, say since the later Middle Ages, poets were not imagined as tortured at all. Most often they were men, and unfortunately, until a certain point in the 19th century, they were almost always men, who, you know, they participated in business, diplomacy, government, and basically the world of affairs. And that includes somebody like Shakespeare, who was very much a middle-class businessman. For that kind of poet, poetry was often written as part of this world of affairs, and people read it not only to encounter the expression of emotions, but all kinds of knowledge about history, politics, and everything else. Now, you know, there were always poets who cultivated an image of the figure inside the poem, the speaker, as suffering in the name of, say, unrequited love. People like the troubadours in southern France in the later Middle Ages, or Francis Petrarch in Italy in the 14th century. But for the most part, these kinds of figures weren't to be confused with the poets themselves, who were, as I say, men of affairs. They were generally too busy to be tortured. And the big change comes with Romanticism in the later 18th and 19th century, as you say, and it all changes there.
And one of the ways that it seems to change is that kind of tapping into a sense of turbulence. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, the reason that Romanticism is such a seismic change in the period is that it proposes a different relationship between the individual consciousness and the material world as well as the metaphysical world. And suddenly the perceptions of individuals matter a great deal more. And therefore, poetry adapts to it, and a poem becomes the sort of the register or the instrument on which the poet records his or her perceptions about nature, about the cosmos, and suddenly that relation between the individual consciousness and the rest of the world is just it just exists on a different philosophical basis. And so the sensitive capacity of the poet comes to matter a great deal more. And then you get figures like, in English, John Keats, who died at age 25, Percy Shelley, who I think died at 29, Lord Byron, who died at 36, who have very turbulent lives, are very, for the most part, very much intellectually adventurous kinds of figures who are thinking about these philosophical questions and thinking about how poetry can respond to them and how a different kind of poetry is necessary in order to for the poet to register sense perceptions and philosophical intuitions about the world around them. They come to epitomize this kind of poet, and then from their experiences we get this image of the tortured poet suffering in a garret and, you know, writing timeless lines that will be discovered only after his death, which is basically Keats.
Yeah, it's Keats. But Byron is interesting. Byron, I think, it begins to create a template that goes straight forward to Jim Morrison, John Lennon, Kurt Cobain. His name becomes an adjective. Byronic is a thing.
Yes.
Lady Carolyn Lamb calls him mad, bad, and dangerous to know. Which, by the way, I think is the title of at least three different rock albums. There's this idea of this guy who his persona and his art are very commingled, and that there's this, and there's this edge. And I think that's kind of a new thing.
It is absolutely a new thing. He probably isn't the very first poet in Western culture who has that kind of persona outside the poem that lends itself to, as you say, having an adjective, Byronic, and having a kind of an image in the minds of people who may have never read the poetry. but he's one of the very first to have that. And that becomes a very important subset of this tortured poet notion. It's sort of the public face of that. And in his case, a kind of, I guess you'd say, a different way of being tortured than that of Keats and Shelley, who were maybe a little more intellectual, a little more philosophical, a little less dashing and political, you know. So it's just a different version of what amounts to the same moment in the development of a certain idea of the poet.
So if we move a generational cohort or so forward, we start to get a slightly more punk rock version of this. You heard the song we opened with, Verlaine and Rimbaud. You know, Verlaine coins this phrase, poet maudit, the accursed poet. And you start to get that idea of a poet who's misunderstood by society, has a short, tragic life, as you were talking about with the British poets before. There's that kind of live fast, die young, leave a good-looking corpse.
Right.
And there's also kind of a culture that grows up around absinthe and other intoxicants. So you've got Rimbaud, Baudelaire, Verlaine, Zola, Poe, Van Gogh, Wilde, all these artistic types. They're consuming absinthe and laudanum and other stuff. There's kind of a culture that's growing up that not only is there a sense of being tortured in the soul, but maybe using certain balms to do something about that.
Yeah, and to have a kind of dissolute life and a kind of a life often lived in public and with a kind of inseparability between the private experience and then the public image that becomes it's a template, as you say, for a certain kind of late. You know, I think of it as sort of decadent romantic poetry. That's the age of Poe, Baudelaire, Rimbaud. It's late stage romanticism that has been naturalized after a couple of generations. So it's not a poetry of philosophical crisis anymore as it was at the beginning of the 19th century. Now it's more exploring what can be the cultural resonances of this kind of stance, and how can the poetry continue to develop under these premises and explore what basically eventually becomes symbolism and a different notion of the relation of figurative language to the poem, and it's just a further development of the high romantic aesthetic and philosophical position.
But I mean, as that begins to unfold, and some of this seems like lives lived almost performatively in that way, mm-hmm. Maybe they were, maybe they weren't, maybe they just were who they were. But we start to get that idea that poetry and poetic truth is tied up inextricably with suffering. It isn't something that holds true all the way through, and we can look at lots of poets who seem to be relatively happy people. But what do you make of that linkage that persists for so long?
Well, my take on it is that, in the case of the early figures, I was talking about Keats and that generation, it is a lived fact that they were tortured in their particular ways. But after a certain point, it becomes a stance, and those are the later 19th century figures that you were talking about. And then eventually it becomes almost a kind of a resource, like something that can be adopted at will, that doesn't necessarily involve empirical suffering, actual suffering in the world, but it may or may not. I mean, any one of us may or may not be suffering privately at any time, but it becomes a resource that can be exploited in the poetry when a poet wants to evoke that that kind of figure and wants to activate the template, so to speak. It becomes available for that. I think of somebody like in the 20th century, somebody like the Irish poet William Butler Yeats, who is in his personal life not particularly tortured, but knows how to evoke a kind of vanished romantic moment when he wants to, and he can sort of exploit it at will. He has a wonderful poem called September 1913 about the sort of a critique of the state of the Irish independence and nationhood in the 20th century. And there's a refrain at the end of every stanza of that poem: "Romantic Ireland's dead and gone. It's with O'Leary in the grave." O'Leary being an Irish separatist who'd been dead for many years. And he wants actual romantic poem uses the word romantic. That's a term that's applied from outside the poetry. The poets themselves don't tend to use that term in the high romantic period. But Yeats invokes it because it is now a kind of a shorthand for something that he wants he wants his audience to recognize his affinity with. So it gradually becomes a resource for later poets, and they can be sort of half in it, half out of it in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think Yeats doesn't really, as you say, he doesn't really track as a tortured poet. He's certainly not wasting away in some garret. He's hanging around in lovely houses in the west of Ireland, and he's a mm-hmm. member of the Irish Senate for a couple of terms.
Right.
He's not like the Lake poets very much at all. And we should also say that it was easy enough to point to some relatively happy poets, or at least not grotesquely unhappy poets. If I got up from my chair and walked about 20 steps to the other side of the building, I could see out the window the route that Wallace Stevens walked to and from his job at a large insurance company. And, if you read Stevens's poems, you think, well, he seems like he might be kind of tortured, but there's no real suggestion mm-hmm. that he was, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. And Stevens, of course, in Hartford is the ultimate poet who has a complete, what appears to be a complete separation between his private life as an insurance executive and this sort of very philosophically rigorous and sort of adventurous poetry. But among his contemporaries, William Carlos Williams is a physician. Yeah. T.S. Eliot is a bank clerk and then later an editor. And, not with the possible exception of Eliot, who, did have a nervous breakdown at some point. These are not for the most part, these aren't tortured people. These are, but they do know how to create, how to evoke that model when they want to.
And coming kind of coterminous with them or a little bit after, we have another wave in America of genuinely tortured poets. We've got Robert Lowell, yes. We've got Sylvia Plath, we've got Anne Sexton. And you really do have this sense that either this is an incredibly dangerous occupation or the people attracted to it or activated by it have some built-in dangers. But say a little bit about that.
Well, so the so-called confessional poets who appear in the 1950s, mostly the late 1950s and early 1960s, among whom you, as you mentioned, Anne Sexton, Sylvia Plath, and probably the most exemplary figure in this kind of thing is Robert Lowell, who is who starts off by writing a kind of mannered poetry, very much influenced by the high modernists, but toward the end of his career is putting diary entries of his own and other people's right into the poetry and turning sonnets into a kind of transcript of actual back and forth, you know, with his wife and so that is a kind of you know, Lowell really pushes it to the limit toward the end of his life as a kind to turn poetry into a kind of record of suffering and after Lowell, you know, I mean, the confessional moment sort of spends itself after that as a different kind of something else counts as avant-garde after that, and poetry becomes much more interested in experimenting with language rather than emotional tonalities of the poems. But so that becomes in a way a kind of the whole confessional moment, that whole episode is a kind of mid 20th century episode that is the sort of long deferred coda to what we saw in the 19th century. It comes back again with a vengeance in a generation that looked to poetry that way. I should also say, though, you know, that the one reason that generation is cultivates that kind of a stance is that they are very much influenced by the new criticism of the mid 20th century, which sort of argues that the biographical, for the most part, argues that the biographical background of poetry is not relevant to its interpretation, and these poets, having been sort of had that idea inculcated in them, start to experiment with the idea, well, what if they do write a poetry in which biography can't be ignored, in which biography is really in a way that really harkens back to the Romantics, in which biography is really inseparable from the poetry, and we can't ignore it, and we have to account for it. And so that I think that they're in part they're engaged in a kind of generational rebellion against the way that they were taught to think about poetry by the people who are just a generation or a half generation older than them, who were the leading critics of that time.
I've got maybe time for one more question here, Roland Green, and I wish I had time for 30 more questions, but I'm wondering if maybe a through line that cuts across some of the generations, cuts across some of the movements within poetry is an idea of solitude. You know, you think of someone like Rilke, you know, who's a little bit stunted in his upbringing, but is living a pretty engaged life, traveling all over the place. But there's so much solitude and so much of the idea that poetry takes place in solitude, in aloneness, running through his work, in the Lake Poets, in you know, that idea. This is the thing you have to go off and do by yourself. I mean, Richard Wilbur was married to the same woman for 64 years, and she was his muse, and they had this really happy conjugal life. I think that's kind of an exception. It seems like a lonely profession almost in its DNA.
I think that's true. That is a feature of the fact that poetry after the Middle Ages is not a communal activity and is for the most part not read aloud and not recited out loud, you know, not shared in a community, but is read privately. And I think that one thing that you make a very important point, Colin, that solitude is a through line And it is the it connects the solitude of the, I would call it the virtual solitude of the poet, because in fact, as we've said, you know, some of these people are not solitary at all, or they are, you know, very much engaged, but the poetry activates a perception of solitude that in many cases is actually the reader's solitude, that we want to see our own, we encounter poetry as a solitary occupation for the most part, as a solitary experience for us as readers. And to the extent that the poetry represents that, in a kind of, by transferring our solitude to that of the poet in a kind of virtual way, we feel less alone when we read a poem. We feel like we are two solitary individuals communing through the poem. And that becomes, I think, a very important connective device that is important to poetry consistently across movements, across generations, across languages from the later Middle Ages on, a kind of communality in solitude, something like that.
Well, Roland Green, you've brought us in for a perfect landing. Roland Green, professor of English at Stanford University, editor-in-chief of the Princeton Encyclopedia of Poetry and Poetics. His newest work is Five Words: Critical Semantics in the Age of Shakespeare and Cervantes. We'll take a quick break. People will ask you to support public radio in just a couple of seconds. Please consider doing that.
Sometimes even on a subway train. How am I to ever learn about the woodlands and the falling leaves of autumn and such things sublime? When I must spend all my time just trucking around this dirty city, doing what I can to earn a dime, dime, dime.
How did Robert Frost make payment? Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. Hartford Healthcare recently celebrated the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center in Windham. Christy Scott, Vice President of Clinical Operations, describes this new state-of-the-art destination for healing.
Individuals will come if they're suffering from substance use disorder and get individualized treatment. They can stay up to 3 to 4 weeks and receive family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and lots of other holistic care like yoga, trail walking, acupuncture. So it's going to be a great place for people to come and heal.
For those seeking recovery, finding it close to home can sometimes be challenging.
Many individuals travel to Florida and other states that have more treatment centers, so we're hoping by doubling our capacity at Hartford Healthcare, the individuals can stay in their home state with their family and support systems close by.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
All right, we are now going to talk a little bit about that notion of the tortured poet in the context of creativity with James C. Kaufman, professor of educational psychology at the NEAG School of Education at the University of Connecticut. He's the author or editor of more than 50 books, including The Creativity Advantage and The Cambridge Handbook of Creativity. James Kaufman, first of all, welcome to our show. And second of all,
thank you.
I followed enough of your work to know that at least at this point in your career, you're probably a little bit wary of the idea of the tortured artist, the tortured poet, the idea that creativity somehow or other is accompanied by that probable baggage. I think you think the ratio is probably a little bit different than that.
Yes. When I was younger, I was very interested in the idea, and I did some studies on incredibly eminent creative people, and some very small findings were taken a bit, they were exaggerated a bit. I've been more interested in the positive aspects more recently.
Right. I mean, you know, we can't minimize this, that, and once again, I want to caution anybody who's hearing this and feels triggered or anything, there is a 24-hour line you can call just by dialing 988. But I don't know. I remember about a decade or so ago reading a piece by Linda Sexton in the New York Times. She's the daughter of Anne Sexton. She had read about the suicide of one of Sylvia Plath's sons, and she had, I think, made a suicide attempt herself. And, you know, you think about it, even somebody like Elizabeth Bishop, who I think her father died when she was very young, and then I think her mother was institutionalized for mental illness. I mean, sometimes that idea of turmoil and torment and an inner storm is kind of a legacy. It might be passed from parents to the poet or from the poet to their offspring. I mean, I think it is important that we talk about the positive side about this, of this, but the negative side is there, maybe just in smaller numbers than we're led to believe.
Although, if the children and parents also showed signs of mental illness, it would strike me that it might be more genetic or environmental factors mm-hmm. rather than anything to do with their writing or creativity. It's also possible that given that writing can be so therapeutic, as Roland Green was talking about with confessional poets, I mean, it could be that people who are in pain or drawn towards expressing that in what is largely a healthy way to do so, to the point where the poetry may have helped instead of hurt.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. On the other hand, I think creative people, I'm going to use a highly clinical term that I've heard you use. Creative people are often pains in the ass, you know, because they see things differently, because they question the surface of reality. They question the settled order of things. They often are going to be people who, in a lot of congregate settings, for example, the workplace, are going to be the people who maybe are, their thoughts, their perceptions, their novel ideas aren't as welcome. And I suppose that can also create a sense of isolation.
Absolutely. I mean, there is certainly an unconscious bias against creativity. And we've seen this from teacher to student, from workers to other workers, and just in the general population, where we tend to assume, for example, that if a kid's creative, they're more likely, to be a pain in the ass or to be disruptive. Workers who are seen as being creative are seen as being less likely candidates for leadership. So there's absolutely this societal view. I mean, if you think about it, being creative means doing something new and different. Most people don't love change.
Yes. I remember watching the movie Man on Wire about Philippe Petit, the man who walked on a wire between the towers of the World Trade Center. And there's a moment in the film where he talks about that. He talks about his idea of the nature of creativity and that every day should be different. And I remember just sitting bolt upright. The way he phrased it was just so startling to me. And I now have in my office the book that he wrote subsequently called, I think, Creativity, the Perfect Crime. And it's, I think, about the kind of thing that you call, there's sort of small C creativity, stuff you do just for yourself, and then medium C creativity, stuff that you do that may affect the immediate people around you and your community. And then the big C creativity, which some of the giants that we've been talking about on that this show. But I mean, Petit, like you, I think is the big believer in small C and middle C, that you don't have to be a towering figure in your field to use creativity to make your life a richer place. But say some more about that.
Absolutely. It is my very firm belief that everybody can be creative. A lot of times when people hear this, they think, I'm not creative because I'm not a genius. And I mean, I'm not a genius. Most people aren't geniuses. But creativity doesn't mean genius. And there are so many ways to be creative. It could be at work, but it also might not. You can be creative in anything from cooking a meal to gardening to making up a story to keep your kids amused to figuring out how to train your dog. And it's this infusing these daily activities with having to be a little bit different. So much of that is this creative attitude, which is about being open. And it's very much related to this idea of doing something different every day. And this is wanting to try new things, eat new foods, visit new cultures, consider new ideas you hadn't considered.
Yeah, this, yeah. Go ahead. Keep going. Yeah.
This is so related to creativity.
Absolutely. And I totally believe in that. I should say, by the way, one reason we're doing the show also is that April is National Poetry Month. I don't really think that there should be a National Poetry Month. I think poetry should be kind of a constant. But since there's a month for it, one thing that I do every April now is I help my dog, Declan, write a poem. And we usually put that poem up on social media. And I know what his poem is going to be about this April, but I'm certainly not a poet. Declan may be. But that's the kind of stuff that you can do that, you know, doesn't necessarily threaten the reputations of Seamus Heaney or something like that. It's just something that you're doing to make your own immediate world a more interesting place. But maybe we could just spend a moment or two with the big C creativity people, because I don't know. I recently watched the documentary about the making of the song We Are the World, where all these great performers came together in one studio and recorded this song. And there's a moment in the movie where Bob Dylan kind of checks in and he has to sing something, and it just becomes just agonizingly clear that he does not live in the same world as everybody else. He doesn't really know what it is they want him to do. People are going to have to assist him in some kind of special way. You know, it's almost agonizing to watch, but, you know, here's this guy with a Nobel Prize for Literature. You know, there is a sense with some really, really creative people that they are not like us, and they shouldn't be like us. They are here really to lead not a few of us, but a lot of us to some kind of new territory through some previously unopened door. But say a little bit about how you see that.
Certainly, there's a lot of chicken and egg with that. Mm-hmm. In terms of, I mean, if you gave me several billion dollars and everybody treated me like I was the greatest thing in the world, I mean, I would probably not know how to buy a gallon of milk. Mm-hmm. So at a certain point, it's the same case with all the stuff with drugs and alcohol. Is it that that's needed, or is it just when you have a whole lot of money, you can get quite a lot of drugs? It's certainly, I feel like the danger is if we feel like the creative geniuses are allowed, so to speak, to do this. I mean, obviously, yes, you would cut them some latitude, but I think it's a little dangerous to feel, well, this person is absolutely brilliant. They're allowed to be a complete jerk. Because, again, so many of the traits that enable people, including geniuses, to be creative, honestly, they're often a little more associated with more go with the flow, being flexible, not necessarily being people who might need to be cut a wide swath.
Yeah, I think we are going to have to stop there, and I apologize for that. Our show is a little short today because of Pledge. This is a much longer conversation. Maybe we'll have it sometime, but James C. Kaufman is professor of educational psychology at the NEOG School of Education at the University of Connecticut, the author and editor of more than 50 books, including The Creativity Advantage and The Cambridge Handbook of Creativity. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We need to talk to a poet here before we go.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/TAP support. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
So, you've never donated to this station before? That's okay. Public Media Giving Days are a great time to make your first gift. Here's how.
Give now at ctpublic.org/donate.
And time to say some thank yous, starting with the maestro. That would be Dylan Reyes. He's our technical producer today. The senior producer of the Colin McEnroe Show is Lily Tyson, and this whole episode is her jam. And her salute to Taylor Swift, I think, as well. We're going to conclude the show by talking to a poet, because we absolutely have to do that. Sandra Simons is a writer, professor, and author of 8 collections of poetry. Her most recent collection is Triptychs. She's also the author of the novel Asiya. And I have to say that one of the things that I've done this morning is spend some very pleasant time reading some of her poetry. So she's with us now. Hi.
Hello. Hi.
So I think you've listened to this whole show, and maybe the best thing to do is say, I don't know, is there anything you're clamoring to say right away based on what's been said so far?
Well, I'm grateful to have listened to this. It was really interesting. Yeah, I guess for me, I'm interested in the idea of like how a poet comes into being. And I was thinking about what was said and, you know, is it nurture? Is it nature? And the idea of also poetry as therapy. And I don't know if I agree with that. I don't know. I think sometimes it's used in that way in a lot of settings.
I think you had a point to make about Anne Sexton, I think, in that context.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, like with the confessional poets, certainly they were encouraged to write as a kind of therapeutic practice. But I've often found for myself that writing actually brings more torture and more torment. And I don't know like why that is. I think like, you know, like somehow like there's something about language and working with language. I think you mentioned this. It's sort of like it kind of like opens a door into something that's not always seen, felt, or heard on the surface. And that actually can be much more terrifying experience. So I don't know, like, I think it can work both ways. Like it can help and it can also make things worse, which I know that probably no one wants to hear that, but that's just my personal experience.
Well, reading your poetry too, I was thinking about, I mean, there's a whole bunch of chicken egg questions here. We keep getting back to that idea, but there's, I think, a question about some poets: are they abnormally miserable, or are they just more acutely aware of the afflictions borne by all of us? I see that at the end of your poem "Memorandum," which is written to sort of this fox-like figure from fable. You and yet I too am a faltering illusion. Keep my phone on silent through the delirium of days. Foxy R. We're all lonely and can only trick ourselves into believing otherwise for so long. I mean, you seem to be saying that there, that it's not that you're experiencing any kind of unique sense here. You're experiencing what everybody else experiences. Maybe you feel it a little harder right now.
Yeah. Thank you for reading that poem. Yeah, that's Reynard, the medieval fox that I use as a kind of figure in that. I mean, are poets more miserable? I would say on the whole, yes. and I can speak to my own experience. Like I started out, my mom had mental illness and, you know, we grew up pretty poor in Los Angeles in many different apartments. And so she was a reader. So we had a lot of books. She was also the daughter of Holocaust survivors. And so for me, you know, going to poetry was a way to kind of both get away from my immediate experience and then also kind of understand my experience. And so I think, and when I look at my friends who are mostly poets and artists and writers, I don't know if they had such an extreme experience as I did in childhood, but a lot of them certainly had unusual experiences. And I think one thing that's great about poetry is that it's able, and you know, a lot of artists and poets are neurodivergent and kind of looking at the world and maybe a little bit from the outside or perhaps too far inside. And so we get these interesting takes and interesting views and visions of the world that I think is it's valuable. I mean, so it's valuable to me when I read other people's, my friends' poems. And
Well, there's something about poetry too that I think makes us almost inordinately want to know more about the poet. I mean, not just because it's confessional, but because there's the sense that maybe they know something we don't, or there's some secret, either horrible or wonderful, about life that they possess. And so you get movies about Keats, you get movies about Neruda, Ginsberg. I mean, I could go on and on. There are a lot of movies about poets. And like, I don't really need to know. I love Margaret Atwood for her fiction, but I don't need to know that much about Margaret Atwood's life. I can probably sort of guess what it's like. But I want to know more about the lives of certain poets. I don't know. What do you make of that? The idea that the biography, the biographical data is so eagerly sought.
Well, part of it's that a lot of, I mean, I know there are exceptions like Wallace Stevens, but I do think there are a lot of poets who have lived fairly extraordinary lives. I mean, I teach a class not only on confessional poetry, but one on the beat poets. And the students, you know, this is just like, the students love this class, and part of, you know, some of the poetry, frankly, isn't, it's not that great. like as we think of great poetry, but they love the romance of, you know, of Allen Ginsberg and his life. And they just, there's again, like some conflation between living, you know, living in different ways or sort of countercultural ways. A lot of poetry is countercultural, and living in those ways, and that attracts very young people. And young people tend to write poetry, you know, more so than fiction. I mean, they write fiction, but they're really, really can be very good at poetry at a young age. Whereas I think with fiction, it takes a little more time to develop, and some, a little bit more rare to get a great fiction writer, at, you know, like a 21-year-old fiction writer. It happens. So that's what I think about that.
All right. I can ask maybe one more question, but I'll need a quick answer. Yeah. And it's a very provocative question. Do you feel any pressure to kind of lean into that? Lean into the sort of, I mean, I'm even looking at one of your official pictures right now, and you've got a black dress on and a very mysterious side eye kind of look on your face. There's a little bit of a Morticia Adams thing going on there. I mean, do you feel like, you know, that's part of being a poet, is you have to kind of lean in a little bit to that tortured idea?
I'm a sober mother of two teenagers, so I have to stay somewhat sane in order to like live my life. But I'm sure when I was younger, I probably did unrepentantly.
That is the best way. Sandra Simons, it's so great to talk to you, writer, professor, and author of 8 collections of poetry. I recommend it. You can go online and get an early taste of it before you get a volume. Her most recent collection is Triptychs, also the author of the novel Asia. And so thank you so much for listening. And if this meant something to you, or the idea that we tackled something like this, which is typical of the kind of thing that we tackle, please consider supporting us. It's really important, particularly in this fund drive. If you pledge during our show, it means a lot. Mapping out the sky, finishing a hat, starting on a hat, finishing a hat. Look, I made a hat. Where there never was a hat.